I'm standing in today for Paul Weber, who'd normally be fulfilling these hosting duties. On behalf of Paul, as well as the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Sitar, I'd like to welcome you to this teleclass today. And it's my great privilege to honor Sue Sabatsko, teleclass speaker today. Sue is a good friend and also Media Past President of Aging. A little bit about Sue. She's from Arlington, Texas, and she's been involved with the APIC organization in multiple roles for more years than she probably wishes to tell you about. However, she's been very active. She's an APIC text author and just a great resource for all of us. So without any further ado, let me please turn this over to Sue. Sue?
Thank you very much, Sharon. And on behalf of the program, I'd like to say thank you very much for joining us this afternoon or this morning, wherever you may be. Today we're going to discuss bloodborne pathogens across the continuum of care and the potential for transmission of the human immunodeficiency virus, the hepatitis B virus, the hepatitis C virus, and all the other bloodborne pathogens in the healthcare or public service environments is of concern not only to patients and to clients and to healthcare workers and our healthcare facilities, but also to public health agencies, to fire and emergency response personnel, law enforcement and correctional service officers, as well as dental offices, mortuary and autopsy personnel, clinical laboratories, personal service workers, and really the general public too. Moving on to the slide entitled Objectives. Today what we're going to do is we're going to define occupational exposure to bloodborne pathogens and really describe what an exposure incident really is. We're going to review the principles of exposure management, including post-exposure prophylaxis, which we will refer to as PEP. We will discuss management of the infected healthcare worker, and we really want to emphasize how important it is to live by the motto, prevention is primary, which is what the Centers for Disease Control here in the United States uses as their motto. Moving on to the slide entitled Bloodborne Pathogens. Precautions to prevent occupational transmission are really directed at transmission interruption, not only from patient to healthcare workers, but also healthcare worker to patient. Just as a little background, in the United States on November 5, 1999, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which we call OSHA, issued a new enforcement directive to compliance officers in enforcing the bloodborne pathogen standard. Now, OSHA clarified its position regarding the use of engineering control in work practices, but there had been an increase in the number and assortment of effective engineering controls available to employers since we first had the OSHA standard in February of 1992, when the last directive was published. Now, in November 6, 2000, our then United States President Clinton signed into law the Needlestick Safety and Prevention Act, which directed OSHA to revise its bloodborne pathogen standard within 6 months. And on January 18, 2001, OSHA published its revised standard, and that's where we in the United States presently have to be in compliance with. Now, personnel in healthcare settings should also be aware not only state and federal regulations and policies in the United States, but also regulations and policies in the provincial and territory areas of Canada. The next slide tells you about the guidelines that we're going to be addressing today. And this is the one from 2001 from the Center for Disease Control. This report updated and consolidated all previous U.S. Public Health Service recommendations for the management of healthcare personnel who have occupational exposure to blood and other body fluids that might contain HBV, HCV, or HIV. These are bloodborne viruses that can produce chronic infection and are transmissible in the healthcare settings, as we're all very much aware. Data from multiple sources, including surveillance, observational studies, and surveys, are used in this particular guideline to assess the risk of occupational transmission. Moving on then to the next slide is the guideline that was just published last September 30, 2005. And this report updates the U.S. Public Health Service recommendations that we just talked about, but also goes on to address the principles of exposure management, which have remained unchanged, but recommended HIV post-exposure prophylaxis regimens that have been changed. This report emphasizes adherence to HIV PEP, which we will refer to as PEP, when it is indicated for an exposure, the fact that expert consultation and management of exposure should be warranted, and follow-up of exposed workers to improve adherence to PEP, and monitoring for adverse events, including seroconversion, to ensure timely post-exposure management and administration of HIV PEP, clinicians should consider occupational exposures as urgent medical concerns. To prepare for this presentation, knowing I would have many Canadians participating, I wanted to make sure that I was providing information that was consistent with what Health Canada publishes. And so I have reviewed all the information and make sure it is in compliance with the Prevention and Control of Occupational Infections in Healthcare, the chapter on bloodborne pathogens, hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, or human immunodeficiency virus. And when I reviewed all of that, I felt that the presentation was in fact in compliance with what is recommended in Canada. As I go through my presentation, I will also kind of point out differences if there are any. I'm going to start with an OSHA definition that really is applicable to the Canadian setting also. According to OSHA, an occupational exposure is a reasonably anticipated skin, eye, mucous membrane, or parenteral contact with blood or other potentially infectious materials that may result from the employee's duties. An exposure incident on the next slide basically talks about a specific eye, mouth, or mucous membrane, non-intact skin, or parenteral contact with blood or other potentially infectious materials that results from the performance of an employee's duties. Now, Public Health Agency of Canada defines injuries very similarly. Injuries in which one of the infected fluids comes into contact with the healthcare worker's tissue under the skin, such as a percutaneous or following a bite when the skin is broken, non-intact skin, such as a cut, chapped or abraded skin, or a mucous membrane such as the eyes, nose, or mouth. And as we all know, the eyes, nose, and mouth are the mucous membranes that are most often exposed when a healthcare worker is caring for patients or clients within their practice. Now, other potentially infectious materials, OPIMs, is a term used by OSHA, and listed on the next slide are the materials that we consider capable of transmitting the bloodborne pathogens. When I looked at the Canadian definition, again, it's very similar. Body fluids capable of transmitting hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, and human immunodeficiency virus from an infected individual include blood, serum, plasma, and all biologic fluids that are visibly contaminated with blood, laboratory specimens, samples, or cultures that contain concentrated hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, or HIV. Obviously, organ and tissue transplants. Then we have the pleural, amniotic, pericardial, peritoneal, synovial, and cerebrospinal fluids. Uterine, vaginal secretions, or semen are unlikely to transmit hepatitis C virus, but they can transmit HIV and hepatitis B. Now, in the Canadian definition, we see that saliva is listed, but it's for hepatitis B virus only, unless it is contaminated with blood, and then it moves on to the other bloodborne pathogens. Statement is made that feces, nasal secretions, sputum, tears, urine, and vomitus are not implicated in the transmission of HBV, HCV, or HIV, unless visibly contaminated with blood. The risk of transmission from screened, donated blood and manufactured blood products is negligible, both in Canada and in the United States. Moving on to the next slide, when we talk about preventing transmission of bloodborne viruses in healthcare settings, it really requires a multifaceted approach, including promoting hepatitis B vaccination for all healthcare personnel who may have contact with blood and considering all patients as potentially infectious, using appropriate barriers to prevent blood and body fluid contact, and preventing percutaneous injuries by eliminating unnecessary needle use, implementing safety devices such as devices with safety features, and using safe work practices when handling needles and other sharp devices, and safely disposing of sharps and blood-contaminated materials. The next slide talks about the elements of an effective post-exposure management program. Avoiding occupational blood exposure is the primary way to prevent transmission of the bloodborne pathogens. However, post-exposure management is an integral component of a complete program to prevent infection following bloodborne virus exposure. Elements of an effective post-exposure management program include policies and procedures that address the confidentiality of not only the person who's been exposed, but to the source person also. Clearly state how to manage these exposures and are known to managers and those potentially at risk. So these policies and procedures need to be well known and are posted in a visible place. Education and training of healthcare personnel are essential to alleviate misconceptions and fears. Additionally, resources should be available for rapid access to clinical care, post-exposure prophylaxis, and testing for both source patients and exposed healthcare personnel. Injury prevention assessment is also crucial, as each injury provides an opportunity to learn how to prevent injuries. Okay, as far as the elements of post-exposure management are concerned, the key elements of post-exposure management are listed here. Over the next few slides, wound management, exposure reporting, assessment of the infection risk by type and severity of exposure, determination of the bloodborne status of the source person, and appropriate treatment, follow-up, and counseling will be explored in more detail. Post-exposure management as far as wound care is concerned. The first element is to make sure that post-exposure management does include some wound care. And the most recent guidelines from the Center for Disease Control state that wounds should be cleaned with soap and water, which is the same as with the Canadian recommendation, and mucous membranes should be flushed with water. Eyes should be flushed with eye irrigant or clean water. CDC states that there is no evidence that application of antiseptics or disinfectants or squeezing or milking puncture sites provides any benefit whatsoever. They also state that the use of bleach and other agents that are caustic to the skin should really be avoided. I mentioned previously about OSHA's bloodborne pathogen rule and the revisions that took place as of January 18, 2001. And just so we're clear, I just wanted to mention that the revisions modified the definitions relating to engineering controls. It directed the employer to really revise an updated exposure control plan annually and mandated that frontline workers have input into the selection of safe medical devices. It also directed employers to maintain a Sharps injury log. Now, I know that documentation of an injury in both countries is very much part of standard of care. So we would want to make sure that the sharp injury log included the identification of the device that caused the injury, the location of the incident, and a description of the circumstances surrounding the incident. And this is important to collect this information for tracking and trending. The next slide continues to talk about what kind of information should be included on the Sharps injury log. We should include information about the procedure that was being performed at the time of the exposure, the body part that was affected, any objects or substances that were involved, and then the main thing to remember, once again, is that we have to protect the privacy of the injured employee as well as the privacy of the source patient or person. At this point, we're going to move on to specific bloodborne pathogens, and we're going to start by talking about the hepatitis B virus. Approximately 1,000 healthcare workers became infected in the United States in 1991 with hepatitis B. However, this particular number represents a 90% decrease since 1985, and that, of course, is the result of having a very effective hepatitis B vaccine available to protect our workers in the healthcare settings. It is estimated that there are 100 to 200 deaths in healthcare workers annually. If there is a positive hepatitis B surface antigen source to a healthcare worker exposure incident, in other words, there's a percutaneous exposure and the source is hepatitis B surface antigen positive, and if the worker is not protected against hepatitis B, there is up to a 30% risk of transmission. Post-vaccine screening is advised for personnel at ongoing risk for blood exposure to really determine whether response to the vaccination has occurred and to determine need for revaccination. It is recommended to revaccinate non-responders with an additional three-dose series and to retest. A 1-inch or a 1.5-inch needle should be used to administer the vaccine into the deltoid muscle, depending on the side of the recipient's arm. We have to make sure that the needle is getting the vaccine into the muscle. If still non-responder, then test for hepatitis B surface antigen to make sure that the worker does not have chronic antigemia. Screen non-responders and chronic dialysis centers who do not respond for hepatitis B surface antigen and antibodies every 6 months. Some of the risk factors for non-response that have been cited are such things such as the age of the recipient, whether or not they're a smoker, obesity, immunosuppressed and renal failure, and family history of non-response. Moving on to the next slide, post-exposure management. Well, you want to make sure you have baseline information of the hepatitis B virus, testing of the exposed person, and we have some baseline information on the exposed person. And if the exposed person has been vaccinated, but you don't know whether or not he or she has made an antibody response, then you want to do baseline testing for hepatitis B surface antibodies to determine whether or not they're present. If the source is not infected or the exposed person is either a known responder or a non-responder, then baseline testing for hepatitis B virus is not necessary. Part of the handouts that I provided, there is a table with the handouts that goes over what to do for post-exposure management when there is hepatitis B virus exposure. One of the biggest questions that is always asked is whether or not booster doses are necessary. So the next slide gives you the answer. Basically, booster doses of hepatitis B vaccine are not necessary, and periodic serologic testing to monitor antibody concentrations after completion of the vaccine series is not recommended. We rely on the immunological memory rather than booster doses to protect against breakthrough memory, and maintenance of the hepatitis B surface antibody level of greater than 10 ml units is not necessary. We're going to move on now to hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is not transmitted efficiently through occupational exposures to blood. The average incidence of anti-hepatitis C virus seroconversion after an accidental percutaneous exposure from a hepatitis C virus positive source is about 1.8%, with a range of about 0% to 7%. With one study indicating that transmission occurred only from hollow bore needles compared with other sharps. Transmission rarely occurs from mucous membrane exposures to blood, and no transmission in healthcare personnel has been documented from intact or non-intact skin exposures to blood. Data are limited on the survival of hepatitis C virus in the environment. In contrast to hepatitis B virus, the epidemiologic data for hepatitis C virus suggests that environmental contamination with blood containing HCV is not a significant risk for transmission in the healthcare setting, with a possible exception of the hemodialysis setting where HCV transmission related to environmental contamination and where poor infection control practices have been implicated, there has been some transmission. The risk for transmission from exposure to fluids or tissues other than HCV-infected blood also has not been quantified, but is expected to be low. 15% of those infected will resolve the illness. One-fourth of the 85% who develop chronic hepatitis will progress to cirrhosis and or death. Post-exposure prophylaxis for HCV is described on the next slide. And for HCV, there really is no recommended post-exposure prophylaxis. Immunoglobulin is not effective, and there are currently no data on the use of antivirals, which may be effective only with established infection. And they are not FDA approved for this particular setting. So if there is an exposure, what do we do? On the next slide, we talk about post-exposure management. Even though post-exposure prophylaxis is not recommended for hepatitis C virus, follow-up testing should be performed. If the source is HCV positive, a test for anti-HCV and alanine transferase, or ALT, should be done 4 to 6 months after exposure. Hepatitis C virus RNA may be performed at 4 to 6 weeks if an earlier diagnosis of HCV infection is desired. A supplemental anti-hepatitis C virus test should be performed to confirm the results of the positive testing. There are no guidelines for therapy during an acute hepatitis C virus infection. When HCV infection is identified early, the worker should be referred to a specialist for proper management. As with all post-exposure management, there should be some counseling done as it pertains to each bloodborne pathogen. For hepatitis C virus post-exposure counseling, the next slide describes what we should do. Healthcare personnel exposed to hepatitis C-infected blood should refrain from donating blood, plasma, organs, tissue, or semen during the follow-up period. There is really no need to modify sexual practices or refrain from becoming pregnant or refrain from breastfeeding or for special precautions to prevent secondary transmission. The healthcare personnel should continue to follow recommended infection control practices, including standard precautions and appropriate use of hand washing, appropriate use of protective barriers, and care in the use of disposal of needles and other sharp instruments. There is no need to modify patient care responsibilities for the exposed person, even if the healthcare personnel is found to have a hepatitis C virus infection. So that covers the highlights and highlights the things that we need to consider as far as hepatitis C virus is concerned. And now we'll move on to the human immunodeficiency virus. On slide 25, we talk about the occupationally acquired AIDS and HIV in the United States through June 2001 in healthcare workers. Through June 2001, CDC followed healthcare workers who were exposed to HIV occupationally. There were 57 documented cases of HIV transmission from person source to a healthcare worker. A documented case is one in which baseline testing for HIV was negative in the exposed worker at the time of the incident and the person source was positive. The worker then converted from a negative to a positive status. There were a total of 137 probable cases of transmission. Now, a probable case is one in which the only risk factor for acquiring HIV was being a healthcare worker who had sustained an exposure and testing was not performed at the time that clearly determined transmission from a positive person source to the worker. The majority of these documented and probable occupationally acquired HIV infections occurred in nurses and clinical laboratory workers. The fact that drawing blood is a job task associated with transmission and the fact that nurses and laboratory workers draw blood may contribute to this incident. The next slide begins to talk about a case control study that was done in 1997. The findings of this case control study on the acquisition of HIV occupationally was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1997. There were 33 cases, mainly from the United States, and 679 controls, all from the United States. Lower titer exposure was when the patient was asymptomatic and had a high CD4 count. A higher titer exposure was when the patient had advanced AIDS with a primary HIV infection and a high or increasing viral load or low CD4 count. The results of this case control study really identified risk and what risk increases for exposures, for transmission during an exposure. The case control study indicated that risk for acquiring HIV from a positive person source increases for exposures that involved a deep injury with a device with visible blood that had just been removed from the person source's vein or artery, and the person source died of AIDS within 60 days post-exposure. The next slide talks about the average risk of HIV infection by exposure route. The average risk of acquiring HIV infection from a positive person source from a percutaneous exposure such as a needle stick was 0.3%. From a mucous membrane splash, the average risk is 0.1%, whereas the risk from an exposure of blood or other potentially infectious materials on non-intact skin is less than 0.1%. These are very comforting to those of us who have to counsel employees or workers, but at the same time, there is a risk, and the worker, we have to recognize when we're working with workers who have had an exposure to HIV, that it is a very frightening experience, and we have to be very sensitive to their concerns and make sure that they are being reassured and that we are giving them everything possible to help them through this event. When we talk about post-exposure management, healthcare personnel with an occupational exposure to HIV should receive follow-up counseling. They should receive post-exposure testing and a medical evaluation, regardless of whether they go on to receive post-exposure prophylaxis, which we will call PEP. An FDA-approved rapid HIV antibody test kit should be considered for use in this situation, particularly if testing by EIA cannot be completed within 24 to 48 hours. Repeatedly reactive results by EIA or rapid HIV antibody tests are considered to be highly suggestive of infection, whereas a negative result is an excellent indicator of the absence of HIV antibody. Confirmation of a reactive result by Western blot or immunofluorescent antibody is not necessary to make initial decisions about post-exposure management, but should be done to complete the testing process and before informing the source person. Direct virus assays, such as HIV P24 antigen EIA, or tests for HIV RNA or HCV RNA for routine HIV screening of source persons are not recommended. Testing of needles or other sharp instruments implicated in an exposure, regardless of whether the source is known or unknown, is not recommended. The reliability and interpretation of finding in such circumstances are unknown, and testing might be hazardous to persons handling the sharp instrument. If the source person is HIV seronegative and has no clinical evidence of AIDS or symptoms of HIV infection, no further testing of the person for HIV infection is indicated. The likelihood of the source person being in the window period of HIV infection in the absence of symptoms of acute retroviral syndrome is extremely small. Let's move on to consideration when using some of the considerations we have to have when we're using PEP or PEP. At present, the risks for occupational transmission of HIV have been described. Risks vary with the type and severity of the exposure, so that is one of the things that we have to think about. Because all antiretroviral agents have been associated with side effects, The toxicity profile of these agents, including the frequency, the severity, the duration, and reversibility of side effects, is an important consideration in selecting the HIV PEP regimen. It is really important to weigh these considerations carefully. Moving on to the next slide, when we talk about HIV PEP, if indicated, you want to start PEP as soon as possible after the exposure, preferably within hours rather than days of exposure. If a question exists concerning which antiretroviral drugs to use or whether to use a basic or expanded regimen, the basic regimen should be started immediately rather than delay PEP administration. The optimal duration of PEP is unknown. Because 4 weeks of ZDV appeared protective in occupational and animal studies, PEP should be administered for 4 weeks if it is tolerated. Reevaluation of the exposed healthcare person should be strongly encouraged within 72 hours post-exposure, especially as at this point in time, additional information about the exposure or the source person becomes available. If PEP is offered and taken and the source is later determined to be HIV negative, PEP should be discontinued. Although concerns have been expressed regarding HIV negative sources being in the window period for seroconversion, no case of transmission involving an exposure source during the window period has been reported in the United States. Another consideration is addressed on the next slide, which has the implications of having possible resistance to antiretroviral agents. In other words, the human immunodeficiency virus that the worker has been exposed to, is it resistant, and are we giving the worker the best antiretroviral agent to treat that exposure? Well, resistance to antiretroviral post-exposure prophylaxis drugs and transmission of resistant viruses has been reported. Nevertheless, despite studies and case reports, the relevance of an exposure to a resistant virus is not understood. Because most HIV-infected patients take many drugs, it may be difficult to know which drugs their viruses may be resistant to. Resistance occurs with all the available antiretroviral agents, and cross-resistance within drug classes is frequent. Continuing on the next slide, it is recommended that drugs be selected to which the source person's virus is unlikely to be resistant. Testing of the source person's virus for resistance at the time of the exposure is not recommended because the results will not be available in time to influence the choice of the initial drug regimen. However, in cases where resistance is suspected, expert consultation is advised. The next slide addresses the issue of what we need to consider if the exposed person is a pregnant person. Pregnancy is not a contraindication for post-exposure prophylaxis, and therefore the exposed person should make an informed decision about post-exposure prophylaxis. When choosing a regimen is much more complex for pregnant women, obviously. Some drugs may exacerbate the physiologic changes in pregnancy. Data are limited on the potential effects of antiretroviral drugs on the developing fetus or the neonate. The short and long-term effects of the fetus or newborns are unknown, and most of the data are for only one drug, zidovudine. Some post-exposure prophylaxis drugs are definitely contraindicated during pregnancy. Moving on, we're going to talk about follow-up HIV testing of the exposed person. What would be appropriate? Well, if the source was HIV positive, HIV testing of the exposed person should be performed at 6 weeks, 3 months, and 6 months post-exposure. EIA is the standard test, and direct virus assays such as P24 antigen and PCR for HIV RNA are not recommended. Extending the follow-up testing to 12 months post-exposure is recommended for healthcare personnel who become infected with hepatitis C virus following an exposure to a source who is co-infected with HIV and hepatitis C virus because of the possible delay of HIV seroconversion, but is optional in other situations. The next slide talks about monitoring for PEP toxicity. Besides follow-up serologic testing, additional monitoring for PEP toxicity is needed if post-exposure prophylaxis is taken. A complete blood count and renal and hepatic profile should be done at baseline and 2 weeks after starting PEP. Additional follow-up testing should be performed if the PEP regimen includes a protease inhibitor. For example, exposed persons on indinavir should be monitored for hypoglycemia, crystalluria, hematuria, hemolytic anemia, and hepatitis. The regimen should be discontinued or modified if toxicity is noted. Expert consultation is encouraged if post-exposure prophylaxis toxicity does develop. Now, post-exposure counseling is recommended for HIV-exposed person as well, and information about the side effects of the post-exposure prophylaxis drugs, the signs and the symptoms of acute HIV infection, such as fever, rash, and flu-like illness, should be provided. In addition, the prevention of secondary transmission through sexual abstinence or use of condoms and avoiding blood or tissue donation should be emphasized. And finally, transmission of HIV or drugs through breast milk and post-exposure prophylaxis drug risks should be discussed if the exposed person is breastfeeding. Once again, no work restriction is indicated. What we have covered so far is HIV, hepatitis B virus, and hepatitis C virus, and what to do as far as post-exposure management, not only as far as what kind of tests to provide, a medical evaluation, but also what kind of counseling should occur. Now we're going to move into the infected healthcare worker and how do we handle a healthcare worker who is infected with a bloodborne pathogen. Now, one of the things that I think we need to consider is the fact that the healthcare worker who has had a previous significant exposure or has personal risk factors in their personal behaviors that would be high risk for acquiring HIV, hepatitis B, or a hepatitis C viruses, that they should definitely seek testing and make sure they're aware of what their status is. Now, one thing that you have to be aware of, if we become knowledgeable in the course of our employment as either an infection prevention and control professional or as an employee health or occupational health professional, and become aware of the worker's status, and it happens to be positive, we have to be extremely careful that we do not disclose this without the permission of the healthcare worker. That would be a direct violation of their privacy. Now, as far as infected healthcare workers, if they have an infectious disease that could put a patient at risk, they have a fundamental ethical principle that they should follow. They should seek medical attention and medical evaluation and make sure that somehow there is some kind of a consideration as to what job tests they can and cannot perform in order to provide a safe work environment for the patients and clients that they are caring for. Now, a comment about the infected healthcare worker's physician. And it was commented that if the physicians who care for our infected healthcare workers, that they are encouraged to seek advice on how to assess the work practices in a healthcare setting and what the potential risk for transmission actually is, so that they are well informed and able to make a definite recommendation as to how and when and whether or not this healthcare worker can perform certain job tasks without putting the recipient of the healthcare at risk. I remember back in the United States, probably in the beginning of the early 90s, we talked a lot about exposure prone, and their Canadian definition of exposure prone I found and wanted to go over it with you. It's very similar to what we discussed in the United States. There were some states that put in a recommendation or a law that we had to come up with a list of what procedures were actually exposure prone, and that was kind of backed off on. Instead, we went with a general condition of what might lead to exposure and what would be exposure prone, as opposed to listing separate diseases. The Canadian definition says that a hepatitis B virus, C virus, and HIV transmission from healthcare worker to patient would most likely occur when there is digital manipulation of a needle tip in a body cavity, simultaneous presence of healthcare worker's finger and needle in the sharp instrument in a blind or a highly confined site. And that's very, very similar to what was defined here in the United States. On the next slide, we talk a little bit more about how HBV, HCV, HIV transmission from a healthcare worker to patient most likely would occur during the repair of major trauma injuries or when there is major cutting or removal of oral or perioral tissue. At this particular time, I've completed what I wanted to go over with you all. I feel as though we have defined occupational exposure to bloodborne pathogens and described what an exposure incident is. And then we have reviewed the principles of exposure management, including post-exposure prophylaxis, such as PEP. In addition to what I went over on the slides, I provided handouts from the MMWR of September 2005 that there's some boxes and some tables there that kind of go into detail as to what is a low-risk type of injury versus a higher risk and what kind of post-exposure prophylaxis should be considered. And the fact that there should always be expert consultation. In the United States, we have a CDC PEP line, and we have that number posted for our ER physicians, for those of us who work in occupational health. Everywhere, we just kind of make that number available and refer our physicians to it if they call us from the outside wanting some expert consultation. We refer them to the CDC PEP line. We also discuss the management of the infected healthcare worker and some of the issues that surround having a worker who is positive for one of the bloodborne pathogens, and kind of looking at individually, every single case should be weighed individually as to what type of job they normally do and at what risk their job task could put the client or the person or the patient at risk. So we have that has to be considered on an individual basis within the organization. And, of course, the last slide just talks about what we hope to be our motto all the time, and that is that prevention is primary. At this time, I've completed my presentation, and I'm open for questions or discussion. Sharon?
Thanks so much, Sue. This was a great presentation. I think for people in an entry level, all the way through those of us that have been involved in the field more years to mention.
Sharon and Sue?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Mary in Calgary. I just want to say that we really enjoyed the presentation, and there's four of us in the room here, and I don't think we have any questions, but thanks, Sue.
We've been hearing some information here that we should be providing PEP for our employees under 3 hours.
Okay.
And I see in your box here that you're looking still at 24 to 36.
Well, let me just say that's really not let me just clarify that. A couple of years ago, Linda Chiarello, who was instrumental in putting together the 2001 guideline from CDC, gave a presentation, and I heard, and at that time, they did away with has to be offered within 1 to 2 hours, because a lot of people weren't getting post-exposure prophylaxis if it had surpassed 2 hours. So CDC changed their wording to as soon as possible.
Ah.
Okay. So and then really wondered how effective it would be after that 24 to 36. But I think you go ahead and you offer it. I think the main thing is that if people delay reporting and they and it's been more than 2 to 3 hours, you want to still consider giving it to them. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because I think we got so rigid on 1 to 2 hours that some people literally interpreted that and failed to offer it to people if it had been longer than that. And you know that's a very short turnaround
absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely, and to try to make the decision for yourself whether to have it or not,
right?
You need longer
time,
than 1 to 2 hours.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I hope that clarified that.
It did.
Thank you.
Just a question about follow-up blood work done on someone who is exposed to HIV or who has an exposure. If your HIV, if your source is HIV negative, are we understanding from you that it's not necessary to do follow-up blood work to test for HIV?
That's correct. I've been in this business for, 23 years, and we went through a series of years where we would do, regardless of what the status of the HIV status was of the patient, if it was negative, we still tested at 6 weeks, 3 months, and 6 months post-exposure. When the 2001 guidelines came out, it was very apparent in those from the CDC that if the source person is totally negative at the time of the exposure for testing and they're HIV negative, HBV negative, and HCV negative, there's been no exposure to a bloodborne pathogen, so you don't have to follow with 6 weeks, 3 months, and 6 months post-exposure. The only time you might want to do that with HIV is, just repeat what I said earlier just to be clear, if the source person is co-infected with HIV and HCV, you would want to make sure that you continue your HIV testing of that worker up to 12 months. So if you've been doing that testing at 6 weeks, 3 months, and 6 weeks, 3 months, and 6 months post-exposure, even though everything was totally negative, we have stopped doing that in our practice here in the States.
My question is around the testing of the source patient, and we've been recently discussing issues around sort of informed consent of testing the patient, the source patient, and pre-test counseling. Have you sort of addressed those issues?
Oh, yes, in all different ways, to the point of what we do, if the patient, now we have a couple different ways of addressing them, and it's probably, we have on our admission sheet when the person comes to the hospital and signs in, there is a paragraph that says, in the course of your hospitalization and there is an event where a healthcare worker has been exposed to your blood may be tested, and that's glanced over. So we even though that's there, that does cover us if we are unable to get to the person who was the source person. But what we like to do, and even though it says you don't have to, I really feel as though it's better from a risk management standpoint. If there's been an accident to one of our workers and we go and talk with the source person or their family, explain the situation, let them know that they had signed that, but we wanted them to be aware that we were going to be doing the testing. And if there was any positive results, they would be related to their attending physician. That's how we've been doing it. We do let them sign for us, even though there's no requirement, because we have state laws that each state is a little different perhaps, but overall the general philosophy behind it is that it's implied. We have laws that we have to test the person's source. If someone refuses, then we have to go through our local health authorities or county health authorities to get a subpoena and all that. Most people understand and just give us their permission, but in the event that perhaps we have a situation where maybe it was in the ER and we have all this blood, we just go ahead and test because they had signed when they came in that testing might take place.
Mm-hmm. Well, the difficulty that we run into is the requirement for pre-test counseling. And it's having a general sort of consent formed at the time of admission. The admission does not give
you're exactly right. We're exactly right. But we also have the law on our side here, which says that we have to need to do the test. And we have situations from time to time, and I assume you all do too, where our first responders, such as our EMS folks and our firefighters or someone might have an exposure, and tracking down the patient and we might have blood available, we would go ahead and test.
Okay, thanks, Sue.
I think we make my personal thing with that, Bruce, is that we would go forward with as much effort as we can to do the counseling, let the person's source know what's going on, and, if we can do that. I recently had an exposure incident where the person was in the ER, left, the physician had this needle stick, wasn't concerned about it, but got to thinking about it later and resurfaced, and we had to track the woman down. And she was very gracious and came back to the hospital and, it was no problem. But we try to do that as much as possible, get their permission. It's still a problem, though, isn't it, Bruce?
Certainly is.
Yes.
I really want to thank you for all the Canadian references in the presentation. That was great. But we did have a request. We've been discussing your comment that when people are admitted to your hospital, they have to sign a consent that their blood will be tested if there's an exposure to a healthcare worker. Would it be possible to send the wording of that?
Oh, I'd love that. Would be fine. I'm trying to think of how the best way to do that is. Should I send it to Paul?
Yeah, I think the best way is
we'll
send it to Paul.
Okay.
And then he can distribute it out to the people on the teleclass.
Okay. Is that okay? I'll do that, Judy.
That's
okay?
Terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Sue, and thanks to all of you for participating. I know we're dealing with all kinds of climate issues throughout the United States and Canada, and we're glad you were able to participate.
And this is Sue, and I truly appreciate all your participation also. Thank you.
Bye now.